Welcome. I'm Adrienne Sudhalter, Assistant Research Curator for the Bauhaus Exhibition. Welcome to the last evening in our series of talks focusing on women and the Bauhaus. I'm going to keep my introduction short because we have three speakers tonight. But before we get started, I want to say a heartfelt thank you to Sarah Peter for her role in focusing attention on the contribution of female artists at the Museum of Modern Art, and to the Modern Women's Fund in particular for making these lectures possible. Tonight we are going to be considering the work and career of Lili Reich. Reich belongs to the last phase of the Bauhaus's history. She was appointed to the teaching staff by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe in 1932, during the last semester that the Bauhaus was in Dessau, and a year before the school was closed by the Nazis. As head of the Ausbau, or Interior Finishings Department, as well as the Weaving Workshop, Reich was the second woman, following Günter Stutzel, to become a master at the Bauhaus. Before coming to the school, Reich had established a reputation as one of Germany's leading interior designers. In 1920, she was the first woman to be elected to the board of directors of the German Werkbund, and after meeting Mies in 1924, she collaborated with the architect on a number of important exhibitions. Our first speaker, Matilda McQuaid, will begin tonight's talks with a discussion of the retrieval of Reich's legacy, which owes a great deal to Matilda's own groundbreaking exhibition of Lili Reich's work that she organized for the Museum of Modern Art in 1996. Following Matilda's talk, Despina Stratigakos will discuss the evolution of Reich's career, considering the educational and professional structures available to aspiring female architects in Germany in the pre-war period. Despina's talk will be followed by Maria Michaela's discussion of the emergence and significance of artificial fabrics in Germany during and after the war, which had an impact on Reich's professional opportunities, especially her displays for the textile industry. Each of these talks will be about 25 minutes in length, and after the last talk, I will invite the speakers to join me at the table where we will engage in an informal discussion about the common points raised and will take questions from the audience. I'd now like to ask you to please turn off your cell phones. Matilda McQuaid is Deputy Curatorial Director at the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum in New York. At the Cooper Hewitt, Matilda was the coordinating curator for the exhibition Joseph and Annie Albers, Designs for Living, in 2004. She has had a long-standing interest in women's contributions to modernism, functioning as a consulting manager of the AIA's Women in Architecture Archive, as an associate editor of the Smithsonian's publication Architecture, A Place for Women. Before working at the Cooper Hewitt, Matilda worked in the Department of Architecture and Design here at the Museum of Modern Art. While at MoMA, she organized a number of exhibitions related to the Bauhaus in which she highlighted the work of Günter Stutzel, Annie Albers, and Mies van der Rohe, among others. Her intimate knowledge of MoMA's Mies van der Rohe archive, which contains some 900 drawings by Reich, led to the revelatory exhibition, Lili Reich, Designer and Architect, of 1996. I'm very pleased to welcome Matilda McQuaid.
Thank you, Adrienne. It's like coming home, so I'm glad to be here. I wanted to just talk a little bit about Lili Reich and her career as an exhibition designer. It'll, I think, have some interesting points in terms of when we talk about her profession and also the textile industry. But I want to begin a little bit with just kind of how she began. By the time Lili Reich was 47 years old, professional woman, by the time she was appointed head of the Weaving Workshop and interior design studios at the Bauhaus in 1932. She had accomplished a lifetime of work as a fashion designer, interior designer, exhibition and furniture designer, and architect when she accepted Bauhaus director Ludwig Mies van der Rohe's offer to teach at the Bauhaus. and her tenure ultimately was cut short by the closing of the school in 1933. Between the establishment of her own office in the first decade of the 20th century, represented by this first project for a display window at a pharmacy, to the peak of her career in 1931, exemplified by this manufacturer's brochure for her line of tubular steel furniture, which was the first series by a woman. And until her death in 1947, she designed and directed dozens of projects for which the Mies van der Rohe archive here at MoMA has close to 900 drawings. And that's just for the projects between 1931 and 47. This collection, which the MoMA received in 1968 as part of the Ludwig Mies van der Rohe bequest, includes sketches, working drawings, presentation drawings, and furniture designs for over 49 projects, with more than half devoted to mass production furniture. More drawings by Reich, however, once existed, most likely from her earlier career, but due to the destruction of her studio and most of its contents during World War II, it is uncertain what all these projects were. Therefore, a full record of accomplishments can only be pieced together through photographs, documents, and drawings from Mies's office, as well as institutions, records from the Bauhaus and the Werkbund, as well as other sources. But what we know is that from 1911 until she met her professional partner, as well as partner in life, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, in 1924, she had a full and successful career as a designer in the broadest sense of the word. Although her early professional career evolved within the context of women's culture at the time, she encountered and was guided by individuals such as Elsa Appler-Legbond, a former student of Henry Vandervelde, who was a designer and co-founder of the Werkbund. Appler-Legbond proposed a somewhat larger role for women. Jobs for women should include not only the textile arts, but also Raumkunst, which meant interior design and window display. Reich engaged in this with the opening of her studio in 1911 and continued to expand the type of projects she undertook, gradually stepping out of the narrow confines of women's work to take on exhibition design and architecture. Perhaps her most important professional partnership, though, began in 1911 when she became involved with the German Werkbund, an association which represented the most successful and significant marriage of art and industry before World War I. She was nominated as a member, as Adrian said, in 1912, the same year that Walter Gropius, the first Bauhaus director, became a Werkbund member. And in 1920, she was elected director, the first woman to hold this position. Her association with the Werkbund continued even after its activities were suspended in 1933, and she spearheaded its revival in 1945. She organized numerous exhibitions for the Werkbund, including show windows and a selection of rooms in the House of Women section at the 1914 German Werkbund exhibition in Cologne, fashion shows that presented reform dress, and a selection of German applied art for a traveling exhibition to the United States in 1921, and this went to the Newark Museum. That same year, the Werkbund elected her to the board of the Werkbund House, where she continued to organize exhibitions for the International Frankfurt Fairs, which took place in the spring and fall of every year. She most likely met Mies in 1924 at an event for Berlin members of the German Werkbund. However, it was not until after her career-turning show, From Fiber to Textile, which presented the process of wool and cotton production, that she began working with Mies in earnest. Their first collaboration was for an exhibition in Stuttgart, The Dwelling, or Die Wohnung, in 1927. In fact, it was Reich's 1926 exhibition, From Fiber to Textile, that Mies cited when he engaged her for the 27 exhibition, Die Wohnung. For this 27 show, she was responsible for an apartment interior and the main exhibition halls, which you see up on the screen, as well as collaborating with Mies on the plate glass hall and Café Samt und Seide, the Velvet and Silk Café. Although Mies most likely had his greatest input spatially, as pointed out in Wallace Miller's essay in Mies in Berlin, Reich reduced an object to its formal properties, which she then exposed to public view, often in new ways. And we see this in The display of Deutsche Linoleumwerk, and I'm sorry they didn't have color photography back then, because these are sheets of colored linoleum that would have been in a similar palette as the plate glass hall, except for the addition of green. But these are gray, black, red, and white linoleum. And they were displayed as wall panels, and circulation space is created through the color changes of the linoleum. The repetition of linoleum celebrates the innovation of industrial production that was a focus of Reich's work throughout her career. As someone who proclaimed herself a commercial and industrial artist, function plus form was her credo, which was very much in line with Werkbund Ames at the time. Mies and Reich collaborate on the Silk and Velvet Café, where they utilize massive lengths of black and lemon-yellow silk and black, orange, and red velvet as walls to partition the café. One could say that this approach of showcasing materials while simultaneously creating space out of them led to the most architectonic of the exhibits Mies and Reich were responsible for in 1927, the Plate Glass Hall, which you see at the bottom, where colored linoleum and glass created a near-living environment. But no other exhibition exploited the use of materials more than her design and installation for the Material Show, part of the 1931 exhibition, The Dwelling in Our Time, or Die Wohnung unserer Zeit, German building exposition in Berlin. Situated on the mezzanine and entrance level to one of the main exhibit halls, the Material Show was divided into 24 groups of interior finishing materials, including marble, wood, and wood veneer, floor covering, carpets, textiles, clocks, mass production furniture, and glass. Of the 50 drawings for this project, over half are devoted to the exhibits and include carefully executed details of display panels and shelves, tables, vitrines, textile racks, and hardware, along with overall plans of the exhibition space. From installation photographs, the viewer is immediately confronted with an unfiltered presentation of the raw material. Planks of wood, for example, lie on the floor, stacked and singly, some perpendicular to each other, and creating an ensemble that could easily be mistaken for the work by minimal sculptor Karl André almost 40 years later. In the glass section, Reich displays sheets of glass in vertical formation, staggering them by height or by their back-to-back placement. This rather simple but elegant presentation recalls their 1929 textile exhibition, which you see on the screen in Barcelona, where Mies and Reich used mouse gray glass partitions behind textile racks to differentiate the fabrics without losing a sense of free-flowing space in the hall. These transparent partitions became a signature device for Reich and Mies in future exhibitions. Reich was also responsible for the ground floor house, for a married couple without children, for short, ground floor house, located on the ground floor of the hall, along with other houses and apartments designed by Walter Gropius, Marcel Breuer, and Mies. Her house was connected to Mies's by an external wall, which you can see in this model that was made for the Lilly Reich show in 1996. So Reich's house is on the left, and Mies's is on the right. Although her interior space lacks the dramatic, free-flowing space of Mies's house, she utilizes a similar formula from her exhibition design work, where contents also create space. Each chair, table, bed, and wardrobe has a purposeful place and property, as fundamental to the architecture as a structural column. The German building exposition represents the last opportunity for Reich and Mies to build without political censorship in Germany. In their 1934 exhibition, German People, German Work, the National Socialists found Mies and Reich's installation design offensive and omitted their names from the exhibition catalog, although the design was not altered. Reich and Mies were responsible for the exhibits pertaining to glass, mining, industrial and domestic ceramics, tiled stoves, and sanitary installations. There are over 100 drawings by Reich for these exhibits. Located in the same hall as the Dwelling in Our Time 3 years before, the centerpiece consisted of three large freestanding walls, one made of rock salt and two of coal. In the glass section, installation photographs reveal a uniform and pristine display of 12 large glass cylinders, as well as sheets of glass displayed in a similar upright and back-to-back formation as in our 1931 material show. In the ceramic section, stacks of porcelain cups, plates, bowls, and pitchers representing the typically mass-produced ceramic wares for domestic use stood in stark contrast to the more decorative china inside the elliptical glass and metal vitrines of Reich's design. But by the time of this exhibition, Reich had already come and gone from the Bauhaus. Her tenure there was just 1 year. As director of both the weaving studio, previously headed by Günter Stölzel, and the interiors workshop, which prior to July 1929 had been separate studios of mural painting, metal, and joinery, Reich's role seemed to be more about producing work that could be easily implemented by commercial industries. This was consistent with the new focus of the school, which began with Hans Meyer's directorship in 1927. It was also partially due to the school's serious lack of funding from the government that it had to rely increasingly on licensing fees from companies manufacturing Bauhaus products. For the weaving studio, Reich taught a course, Combination Exercise in Material and Color, which was befitting her extensive professional experience, which did not include technical knowledge of weaving. This is one of my favorite pieces in the Bauhaus show upstairs. Her weaving studios mainly designed patterns for printed cloths that were marketed commercially together with Bauhaus wallpaper patterns. The textile prints were fairly inexpensive and used for both interior curtains and children clothes. From 1930 onwards, large pattern books from the Bauhaus could be found in almost every architectural office. But how did the Bauhaus shape her and vice versa? Although we know she communicated with the Bauhaus, and specifically Gropius, for participation in Werkbund exhibitions, and certainly visited the Bauhaus prior to her 1932 placement, there's no indication that this school played as a decisive role in her career as the Werkbund. Granted, when she stepped in as the director of the two workshops, it was the most tumultuous time at the school, with little stability for Reich to assert great changes. During Mises' directorship, he placed greater emphasis on architecture, with a number of workshops attached to it. In many ways, Reich was more of a free agent outside of the Bauhaus and was able to float between disciplines, something hard to do within the Bauhaus, which had a fairly rigid protocol for acceptance in the various workshops. When the Bauhaus opened in 1919 and Gropius initially accepted, and I quote, any respectable person deemed suitable by the Master's Council, irrespective of age and sex, end of quote, this soon evolved into the weaving class being declared a women's class, and was one of the few to accept women by 1920. In many ways, she reaped the benefits of Bauhaus training directly through her Werkbund experience beginning in 1912 when she first became a member and 7 years before the Bauhaus opened. She pioneered a visual expression of the design process through her professional exhibition work by altering the prevailing custom of presenting raw materials and techniques as a mere adjunct to the finished product, and choosing material and process as the essence of her installation. Materials were objects and simultaneously defining exhibition elements. They created space as much as they were the content in the space. Perhaps nothing illustrates this better than an encounter, as told to me by Nicholas Fox Weber at the Joseph and Annie Albers Foundation. And I apologize if those who were here a week or two ago and heard him heard the same story. But it has to do with Lily Reich. Reich and Mies had an encounter with Joseph and Annie Albers when Joseph had just been appointed to the faculty of the Bauhaus. Joseph invited Reich and Mies to dinner, and Annie, who was a student then at the weaving workshop, wanted to make sure everything was perfect, as Mies would soon be the third Bauhaus director and hence her and Joseph's boss. Annie's mother had given her a butter curler, an implement that had been suitable in Annie's family's ornament-laden dining room, where butter balls were part of the landscape. In preparation for her esteemed guests, Annie carefully sculpted butter forms reminiscent of flower blossoms. And when the dinner guests arrived, Reich looked at the table and exclaimed, Butterballs, here at the Bauhaus? At the Bauhaus, I should think you'd have a good solid block of butter. This was an insult that Annie never forgot, but is indicative of Reich's clear and unwavering attention to details. Until Adrian asked me to participate on this panel, I had not thought a lot about Lilly Reich since the 1996 show at MoMA. Fortunately, that changed, and here's a couple of installation shots of the show. That changed with the extraordinary Bauhaus show upstairs and the opportunity to re-familiarize myself with the material as well as to catch up a little bit on new scholarship for this panel. In doing so, I realized what a profound effect Reich had on me as a curator and how I wish to present subject matter in my exhibitions with a sensitivity to an object and its form, a simplicity of context, and a straightforward interpretation that allows the public to understand that good design is part of everyday life. Most remarkable is how the art and design world has also embraced her recently. Gosia Makuga, a Polish artist and one of four nominees for the Turner Prize in 2008, presented these three installations called Haus der Frau I, Haus der Frau II, and Deutsches Volk, Deutsche Arbeit, German work, or German people, German work. She also did an installation in 2008 of Haus der Frau II in Mises' Neue National Gallery, which you see on the upper left. Makuga is interested in the politics of exhibition display and creates new narratives with these tubular steel and glass display stands that stand denuded of their contents, except for the installation in the Neue National Gallery, which I think is less successful because of the draped textiles, so that they can better frame the architecture. But as close as they are to the real thing, they are missing the dynamic spatial relationship and conversation that happens when two or more elements are connected in space. I can only speculate that had Reich ventured into this gallery, she would have dragged these stands toward the center, letting them form slots of space within the gallery. But at the same time, she would have appreciated the purity of form and material, a duo that has come to be the hallmark of his pioneering designer's work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matilda. Our next speaker, Despina Stratigakos, is an assistant professor in the Department of Architecture at the University of Buffalo, State University of New York. Despina has published widely on the role of female architects in Imperial Germany. Her brilliant book, A Woman's Berlin, Building the Modern City, was published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2008. Her research has opened up an important new area of scholarship that outlines the broader structural, social, and institutional opportunities available to professional women in Germany at the beginning of the 20th century. Recent articles have focused, for example, on the effects of the First World War on the careers of female architects, on the institutional guidelines within the Werkbund as regarded women, and on the effects of the integration of German technical colleges before the war. Please welcome Despina Stratigakos.
In 1889, Minerva Brace Norton, an American, captured her impressions of life in the German capital in her travel book In and Around Berlin. Interested in education, she visited Berlin University with its 6,000 male students and noted that women could not attend. Curious about the university preparation that boys received at a gymnasium, a 9-year school that emphasized the study of Latin, Greek, mathematics, and science, she asked the director of one such school if she could visit and received this response. A woman in a boys' school? Oh, never ask me any other favor but that. Rejected, she decided to visit a girls' school instead. In 1889, there were no gymnasia for girls anywhere in Germany. Middle-class girls typically attended a higher girls' school, completing their formal education at the age of 16. Asked by the school's lady director what she would like to see, Minerva suggested a mathematics class. Astonished, the director replied, We aim to teach girls to become good wives and mothers, not to teach them mathematics. Embroidery, religion, French lessons, a good dose of the romantic poets, basic arithmetic to balance a household budget book. Girls needed no more than this. As Minerva continued her explorations of the city, however, she encountered women who strongly disagreed. Over the next decade, their voices grew more prominent as they campaigned for access to Germany's institutions of higher learning. Prussia stubbornly resisted integrating its universities until 1908, followed the next year by its technical colleges. Even so, by the turn of the 20th century, small but important school reforms had begun to open up higher education and careers to girls. In integrating new fields, women encountered the sharpest opposition from those professions traditionally considered the most masculine. In medicine, for example, opponents of female doctors argued that women lacked the physical strength needed to perform operations and that their femininity would be forever corrupted by the study of anatomy and venereal disease. Popular representations of the Frau Doctor mocked her manly ways. Such images were informed by the field of sexology developing in Germany and Austria at the end of the 19th century, which classified emancipated women who transgressed social norms as an intermediate or third sex, neither fully male nor female, but something apart. Advocates of female doctors countered such allegations by relying on maternal metaphors evoking women's nurturing natures, as well as by claiming that their practice would be limited to women and children. Virtually no one expected female doctors to treat male patients. Opponents of female architects drew on these popular and scientific currents to discourage women from entering the field. Carl Scheffler, an influential architectural critic, published a treatise on gender and creativity in 1908 in which he claimed that women architects were perverse, displaying mannish physical qualities as well as male sexual desires. In his view, these hermaphroditic creatures were pathetic half-men, unable to achieve true masculine genius. Importantly, the whip of gender conformity could lash both ways. Men, too, could find themselves unable to clear the profession's high masculinity bar. Writing in 1911, the architect Otto Bartning transformed a question about women's capacities as builders into a critique of the weakness of our contemporary architecture, arguing, and I quote, "What our architecture needs to recover is truly not female architects, but rather supremely manful men." Supporters of women architects also drew on prevailing gender norms, arguing that female builders, like female doctors, would find a niche market in areas of design, such as domestic interiors and consumption, that were particularly suited to a feminine sensibility and that exceeded the purview of the academically trained architect. In this way, they would not compete with men, but would rather extend the reach of architecture into new markets, bolstering the profession by addressing the needs of underserved clients, such as housewives. Hermaphrodite or housewife's helper? Neither possibility must have struck aspiring women architects as particularly encouraging. Ultimately, a woman contemplating a career in architecture had to invent a new self, the architektin, the female architect, a creature that few had ever seen and that some doubted could even exist. To forge ahead into this void required a level of courage and imagination that may be difficult for us now to fully appreciate. Presumably, that process began with a consideration of educational options. In Germany, a would-be architect could choose among three academic paths, each of which conceived the builder differently. At the apex stood the technical colleges, or Technische Hochschulen, the elite architecture and engineering academies that trained professionals for the civil service. The four-year curriculum emphasized technical knowledge, but also included humanistic offerings, such as art history and literature, intended to produce broadly educated architects and engineers who could claim membership in Germany's educated elite. After graduating from a technical college, one earned the coveted title of Diplom-Ingenieur, which distinguished the graduate as a highly qualified professional at a time when the title of architect was not yet licensed or otherwise protected in Germany. The credential also earned the graduate the right to sit for the civil service examination, opening the door to a prestigious and secure state position. During the imperial period, a time of unprecedented industrial and urban growth in Germany, most architects worked for the government. Thus, when women began demanding admission to the technical colleges, they encountered strong opposition from those who saw the diploma as the gateway to the civil service. Architects feared the competition for jobs, while government ministers balked at the idea of hiring women as building inspectors. As a result, Prussia agreed to open its technical colleges to women on the condition that female architectural graduates limit themselves to private architectural practice and leave the civil service to men. Given that the private market for architects in Germany was still quite small in this period, being barred from the civil service was not an inconsiderable professional hurdle for women. Nonetheless, after 1909, a steady and growing stream of aspiring female architects matriculated at the technical colleges. Even before this date, women with high academic qualifications could audit courses. Unlike our understanding today of auditing as a casual affair, technical colleges in Germany offered a structured approach to auditing intended to give individuals already working or those without the necessary qualifications to matriculate the opportunity to extend their education. Indeed, one could audit an entire degree's worth of courses, and a good number of women did just that, studying 4 or 5 years as auditors. Amelia Winkelmann, who was 10 years older than Lilly Reich, was the first female auditor to complete a full program in architecture at a German technical college, attending Hanover's Technical College from 1902 to 1907. She then opened an office in Berlin's fashionable West End, establishing the first architectural firm owned by a woman in Germany. Highly successful, her office expanded to 15 employees, including junior female architects. Female patrons and women's organizations commissioned many of her early building projects, such as the Victoria Studienhaus, a residence for female university students in Berlin. The second path to architectural practice went through the building trade schools, the Baugewerkschulen. Building trade schools were socially less prestigious than the technical colleges, and their programs of studies shorter and more narrowly focused. Their mission was to provide highly skilled workmen, assistants, and mid-level managers for various branches of the building trades. For admission, trade schools required extensive practical training on the building site, in some cases of up to 2 years. Given social and legal restrictions against women's physical labor in the public male environment of construction sites, this requirement effectively excluded women. I know of only one woman to graduate from a building technical school in Germany during the imperial period, Katharina Pfeiffer, a bricklayer seen here in 1912 working alongside her colleagues. After the turn of the century, the demand for trained technical personnel led to the creation of private architectural schools for women. The most interesting of these was the Women's Polytechnic in Wismar, a small town on the Baltic Sea, which offered a 3-year diploma in architectural and engineering disciplines. Additionally, students could take courses in the humanities, social policy, and foreign languages, a curriculum that placed the school somewhere between a technical college and a building trade school. Previous practical experience on a building site was specifically not required for admission. Advertisements touted the strengthening effect of the sea air on female bodies, and the curriculum included courses on building methods in the tropics and in the German colonies. While the image of a robust woman architect heading off to Africa might strike us as empowering, at least from a colonial perspective, leaders of the women's movement reacted negatively to such schools, considering them inferior to the technical colleges. Finally, the third route to architectural practice led through the state-run applied art schools. After the turn of the century, these schools began to integrate programs in architectural study, a development championed by educational reformers such as the architect Hermann Muthesius for emphasizing artistry over engineering in the designer's training. Enrollment statistics for these schools reveal that female students were concentrated in departments associated with more traditional feminine skills, such as needlework and ceramics. Greta Zimmermann, who trained with Hans Pulzig at the Breslau Academy of Arts and Crafts from 1906 to 1909, and subsequently worked with him in Breslau and Dessau, was among the few women to graduate from an architecture department. Nonetheless, given the integrated approach to design taught in applied art schools and exemplified by the notion of the Gesamtkunstwerk, the total work of art, students in non-architectural programs could find their way to design practice. Indeed, many successful practitioners, female practitioners in the pre-war period, began by studying another discipline, such as dressmaking. Lastly, while some women chose state-run programs, others trained at private applied arts schools, such as the Reimann School in Berlin. Seeking to boost enrollments, these private schools tended to be more welcoming toward female students. In contemplating her career path, Lilly Reich was unusually lucky in the number of choices available to her. Her parents provided all of their children, including their two daughters, with the best education possible. Most middle-class German families, by comparison, considered their sons' educations their top priority and only grudgingly financed their daughters' studies, even when they could afford to do so, in part because they feared that their educated daughters would educate themselves right out of a husband. Moreover, Lilly received a boy's education, including Greek, Latin, mathematics, and physics, which prepared her to sit for the Abitur, the university qualifying exam. She thus joined a tiny group of privileged German women who possessed this credential. In her memoir, Tekla Schild, the first woman to graduate in 1913 with an architecture degree from the Technical College in Karlsruhe, wrote about the experience of attending the gymnasium for girls established in that city in 1893. She and her classmates were terribly proud of their school and acutely aware of the rare opportunity they had been given as girls. Their teachers expected them to go on to university study, and all but one did. We might expect that Lilly Reich would follow a similar path. Her older sister, Emmy, obtained a doctorate, a rare achievement among German women in the imperial period. Thus, not only did Lilly Reich have the credentials for university study, but she also had a role model. In this context, what she did next seems, at first glance, shockingly anachronistic. She learned how to sew. Specifically, she trained in techniques of machine embroidery, then popular among avant-garde designers. Should we interpret this act as youthful rebellion on Reich's part, an embrace of traditional gender roles in the face of her parents' annoyingly progressive attitudes? We cannot, of course, know Reich's intentions, and our information about her education is limited and based on family members' recollections. Nonetheless, in light of Reich's educational options and subsequent career path, her choice suggests that in pursuing design, she was interested less in conventional notions of architecture as independent object and technical structure taught in the technical colleges, and more in the idea of an inclusive, empathetic visual environment being explored in applied art circles. Her studies at the Wiener Werkstätte under Josef Hoffmann, begun in 1908, and subsequent work with Elsa Oppler would seem to confirm this. While it is true that Reich chose to enter the design profession through the most traditionally feminine of the crafts, embroidery, the gendering of design branches was quickly breaking down in avant-garde circles, with male architects designing dresses and female dressmakers designing buildings. Moreover, Reich's subsequent manner of working suggests she preferred the collaborative design methods of the applied art schools to the emphasis placed on the individual builder at the technical colleges. Thus, I see Reich's decision to pursue college studies less as a rejection of the opportunities created by her Abitur and more as an embrace of a notion of design still foreign among academic elites. Reich's design philosophy was also undoubtedly influenced by her mentor and collaborator, Elsa Oppler, who was 10 years older than Reich. Their close working relationship in the years leading up to the First World War proved enormously productive and launched Reich's career as an exhibition designer. It also marks a pattern of artistic collaboration that Reich would later repeat with Mies van der Rohe. Oppler trained at the Royal Arts Academy in Munich in addition to studying with Henry van der Velde and Peter Behrens. She began her career in Nuremberg as the director of a private applied art school for women called the Kunstgewerbliche Werkstätte des Vereins Frauenwohl. Established in 1901, the school quickly gained a reputation as a leading center for embroidery and the new machine techniques. In 1903, Oppler was hired by the Wertheim department store in Berlin to direct the artistic dress department as well as to serve on the store's artistic board of directors. Additionally, she maintained an independent practice in interior design, which began with domestic projects but soon expanded to theater, exhibitions, and film. The creativity and range of Oppler's practice as an independent woman artist served as a template for Reich, who would follow a similar path. In 1910, Oppler became the director of the Werkbund's new school for display art in Berlin and hired Reich to teach on-site decoration with her. Oppler and Reich were the only two female faculty members on a star-studded roster that included the graphic artist Julius Klinger and the architect Hans Bernoulli. Reich's quick professional rise testifies to her talent in the emerging field of display art, as well as to the support of an influential mentor. When, in 1911, Oppler left the school to work as a stage designer in Freiburg, Reich lost her teaching position under the school's new management. Reich was then hired as a display artist by the Wertheim department store, possibly through Oppler's intervention. The Wertheim department store, seeking to attract well-to-do female customers, cultivated working relationship with some of the city's most exciting female designers, such as Elisabeth von Hahn, the store's trendsetting artistic director of window displays. Wertheim also featured the work of female artists in its Modern Living Spaces gallery, which opened in 1905. Wertheim thus recognized the intimate connections between female consumption and production. While working at Wertheim, Reich accepted her first exhibition commission for Die Frau in Haus und Beruf, a monumental exhibition of women's work that opened in Berlin in February 1912. Inside the exhibition building at the Zoological Garden, visitors encountered a vast and intricately ordered cosmos devoted to women. Women designers had arranged the halls filled with displays of women's labor. An all-female orchestra serenaded the crowd with music by female composers, and female writers stocked a library with books authored and bound by women. So complete and total was the effect that the New York Times accused the organizers of flaunting the absence of men. Fascinated by this show of female self-sufficiency, 500,000 people crowded through the exhibition in the 4 weeks it remained open. Via Villa, Oppler and Reich developed the show's aesthetic conception from the layout of the rooms to the broader physical environment. With 9,200 square meters of exhibits distributed between two vast halls, each with two floors, the designers faced an enormous challenge in bringing harmony and legibility to the whole. Villa, who together with her husband Rudolph owned one of Berlin's most successful design firms, arranged the first hall according to the theme of luxury, taking the department store, and specifically Wertheim, as her model. This choice made sense in the context of the displays, which showcased women's luxury design work, from jewelry to upper-class interiors. The second hall, designed by Oppler and Reich, explored the theme of labor and featured women's work in the colonies, among the poor, and in the nation's industries. To communicate disciplined working female bodies and minds, the designers drew on the aesthetics of the machine hall seen at World's Fairs. Minimal decoration, white accents, and angular forms predominated. Reich's design for a working-class dwelling, also included in the second hall, emphasized a similar no-frills aesthetic. Some 200 reviews in newspapers and magazines conveyed the show's accomplishments to a national and international audience. Rice's work earned her high praise and recognition as a promising new talent. More broadly, the exhibition demonstrated to the German public the importance of women as producers and revealed Berlin to be a vibrant center for women designers. Indeed, the exhibition catalog's list of contributors contains an astounding number of women-owned design firms. On the heels of their successful partnership in Berlin, Reich and Oppler joined forces again, this time with Anna Mutesius, to organize another high-profile show of women's design work, the Haus der Frau, at the 1914 Werkbund exhibition in Cologne. The women's pavilion, designed by Berlin-based Margaret Knüppelholz-Röser, showcased the association's German and Austrian female designers. Reich's duties included handling the correspondence as well as serving on the pavilion's design juries. She also created a living room and a series of shop windows for the pavilion, of which, unfortunately, no images remain. When it opened, the Haus der Frau received harsh criticism from male reviewers who considered its external appearance and internal displays too sachlich or objective for a woman's space. One writer even accused the designers of performing a kind of architectural drag. For these critics, the modern and the feminine remained fundamentally incompatible. Such views were nurtured not only by older gendered stereotypes about creativity expressed by Carl Scheffler and others, but also by the growing competition between female and male designers for developing new markets. With the outbreak of the First World War, the exhibition in Cologne came to an abrupt end. Design opportunities diminished as the German nation shifted its activities, including those of women, to the war effort. Nonetheless, women designers who had achieved so much in the preceding years had every reason to expect their careers to revive when peace returned. In fact, the Weimar Republic brought both gains and losses. On the one hand, legal equality ensured greater access to educational and professional institutions. On the other, the patronage of women and their organizations, which had nurtured female designers before the war, all but disappeared. Once again, women designers face the task of reinvention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was great. Maria Michaela is professor and chair of visual studies at the California College of the Arts. She has published broadly on art and culture in Germany before and after the First World War. She is the author of the authoritative book, The Munich Secession, Art and Artists in Turn of the Century Munich of 1990, an adaptation of her doctoral thesis, and was co-curator of the landmark exhibition, The Photomontages of Hannah Hoch at the Walker Art Center in 1996, that also traveled to this museum. In 2009, with Rose Carol Washington Long, Maria co-edited a volume on Max Beckmann, and she is currently working on a much-anticipated book to be entitled Sein und Schein, Identity in Weimar Culture, which will include work she has presented in various articles and lectures on the production of artifice in film, fashion, art, and other interrelated areas of Weimar culture. Please welcome Maria Michaela.
Thank you so much, Adrian, for the invitation to speak here tonight, and also for the wonderful exhibition that I'm sure you all have seen. It was really groundbreaking and such a pleasure to see. Let me preface my remarks by saying that I maybe am the odd man out, or the odd woman out, as it were. I don't really know very much about Lilly Reich, but Adrian said it was okay, so... be that as it may, what I'm talking about tonight hopefully will make for some productive interplay and exchange of ideas about architecture and textiles. So, let's begin. The date is August 1914, at the outset of World War I, and some 4.5 years before the Bauhaus would open in the German city of Weimar. The Central Powers have the military advantage on land, but the Allies have superior power at sea, in large part because of the famed British Royal Navy. With more than twice as many surface ships as Germany, England makes the decision to blockade the enemy in the North Sea and the Atlantic Ocean, while France and Russia do the same in the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. Germany is effectively cut off from overseas trade and resources, and not just until the end of the war in November 1918, but for a full 8 months afterwards. The ramifications of this concerted action on the part of the Allied powers were many and diverse, and I would like to talk today about one of them, the impact that the resulting deprivation of the era had on Germany's post-war visual and material culture, especially, but not only, on that produced by the Bauhaus artists and designers. Whether they be works made early in the history of the Bauhaus, like this chair designed by Marcel Breuer and Günter Stotze in 1921, or those produced in the 1930s, just before the school closed under pressure from the Nazis, such as this curtain woven by Otti Berger, many of the objects designed at the Bauhaus were decisively influenced by the material exigencies of wartime Germany. But first, a few more facts about the blockade. As soon as war was declared, the Allied navies blocked all ships sailing directly to Germany, diverting them to their own ports, where goods that could be used by the enemy in the war effort were confiscated. At this point, the list of contraband was not long and included the obvious: guns, explosives, copper, lead, rubber, and the like. But as the months wore on, England gradually expanded the list such that by spring of 1915, virtually everything was defined as contraband and blocked from entry into Germany. Initially, Germany got around this simply by ordering goods from the neighboring neutral countries. But the Allies then began to block supplies to the neutrals above and beyond what they needed for their own consumption. Germany was effectively isolated, cut off from all import goods that by 1916 existed only in ersatz form, advertised here in just a few of the ubiquitous newspaper ads for substitute tea, rubber, tobacco, and the like, said to be indistinguishable from the real thing, but hardly so in fact. And so what you're looking at here is on the left, this is ersatz or substitute materials for rubber tires, up here for ersatz tobacco, and then down here for tea, vom echten Tee kaum zu unterscheiden, hardly distinguishable from the real thing. Notably, the same was true of cloth, and this was because of the simple fact that Germany produced none of the raw materials it needed to make textiles. Cotton came primarily from the United States, wool from England, New Zealand, and Australia, silk from France, Italy, Japan, and China, and linen from Russia. With the outbreak of the war, deliveries of Russian linen stopped immediately, and then the naval blockade made fibers from abroad unobtainable as well. Existing stockpiles of cloth initially sufficed to cover the nation's needs, but soon there were no more reserves. Rationing systems were put in place, and the sturdier textiles, wool, cotton, and linen, were for the most part confiscated for the military. This had significant implications for visual and material culture. For one, cotton and linen canvas now became extremely hard to come by, and when available at all, was subject to a luxury tax and thus inordinately expensive. Many artists thus increased their production of works on paper at this time and began to translate their ideas less into paintings than into prints, print cycles, or drawings, like this one that's actually owned by the Museum of Modern Art by George Gross, titled Fit for Active Service, in which fat cat military doctors and officers send starved soldiers back into battle. Photomontage proliferated, insofar as it is composed of photographic images drawn from the mass media and glued not onto canvas, but onto a paper or cardboard support. And some of you might remember this tour de force photo montage by the Dada artist Hanna Höch when it was exhibited here in 1997 at the retrospective of her work. So too did assemblage proliferate, pioneered primarily by Kurt Schwitters, who once described himself as a painter who nailed his pictures together. Because the pressboard or wood support he was now forced to use was firmer than the canvas he could no longer easily obtain, he was able to incorporate three-dimensional tactile objects into his work. And this work, called the Cherry Picture, Merritt's Picture 31, I think is the number, is also owned by the Museum of Modern Art. I don't think it's on display right now, but it consists of paint, cloth, paper, but also wood, cork, metal that is able to be, was able to be affixed to the surface support, to the ground, because it was firmer than canvas that would have been more difficult to hold it. As regards material culture, the lack of cloth was also decisive. The hemlines of women's skirts rose and their width shrunk, as you can see here in this ad for a skirt pattern that required only 1.5 yards of fabric, which to those of you who sew in the audience may seem like a lot, but at the time it was actually very little. The press was filled not just with articles giving helpful hints on how to repair worn clothing, but with ads like this one from tailors and seamstresses who would darn it for you if you couldn't do it yourself. So this is advertising a seamstress who would sew worn stockings, torn stockings, or socks. Entrepreneurs offered good money for used clothing and cloth of all kinds, which would either be resold as is or reconstituted into yarn or yard goods. And here again on the bottom, this is an ad saying I'm looking for cotton stockings and socks, and above for old knitted wool that, as I said, they would sell or reconstitute. Sails, tents, and curtains were particularly valuable, which is what these ads are soliciting, because they were made of long lengths of sturdy cloth that could be used for many purposes. In cities like Berlin, residents of the poorer neighborhoods either took down their curtains to sew into clothing for themselves or sold them outright, a fact that is rarely remarked upon in discussions of works like this one by Otto Dix that is part of a series he made about sex murders, and apologies for the black and white reproduction, but it actually is a destroyed work. Celebrated for exposing Berlin's underbelly during the war and its immediate aftermath, artists like Dix, Gross, and others could, in fact, more easily do so, because without the curtains, the blank windows in the metropolis provided them access, visual access, to what went on behind them. By 1918, the lack of cloth was so acute that the government not only confiscated all the curtains in Berlin's public buildings so as to make use of them for the military, it instituted a program to encourage private citizens to exchange their cloth curtains for ones made out of woven paper. In fact, paper cloth and clothing, touted here in just a few of the many ads one could find for them in the daily press, fulfilled many of the military and civilian needs toward the end of the war and on into the inflationary era, when Germany had access again to the international market, but little purchase power. Treated with a solution that made it water resistant, paper cloth could be washed a number of times without disintegrating, and though somewhat stiff and scratchy, was used for everything from children's clothing and uniforms to underwear and women's dresses. Efforts were also made to find other materials that were available within Germany that could be turned into cloth. Flax and hemp had already been grown in Germany prior to the war and were used in a very limited way to produce fiber for textiles, But now the government experimented with other plants like nettle, peat moss, and rushes. For a year or so, these were widely touted in the press as the solution to Germany's textile problems. And exhibitions with illustrations like these toured the country demonstrating how such fibers could be processed and woven into cloth. The director of the Botanical Gardens in Berlin even wrote a weighty tome on the topic in 1918. 418 pages in length and published in several editions because of demand, the book was illustrated with detailed drawings of plants and gave instructions on how to cultivate, harvest, and make creative use of virtually anything that grew within the borders of Germany to replace the many items, especially cloth, that could no longer be had from abroad. The chair, produced collaboratively by the Bauhaus designers Marcel Breuer and Günter Stulze, can be productively contextualized by such efforts to educate the German public on Ersatzfibers. Primitive, in affect, with its throne-like form and carved frame that bears traces of the chisel, it has been related both to the tribal art of Africa and Oceania that inspired so many avant-garde artists of the early 20th century. He's happy. as well as to handcrafted Hungarian peasant furniture like that which you see illustrated on your right. And of course, Marcel Breuer was Hungarian-born and very well may have known of such designs. Much has rightly been made of the roughness of this chair and its rootedness in the expressionist tradition that characterized the early years of the Bauhaus. Yet it is worth noting that the paucity of traditional materials like cotton, wool, and silk, as well as the efforts of German officials to educate the public in ways to make cloth out of alternative fibers, played an equally influential role here. The tapestry seat and back, so expertly designed by Stürzel, consists of various fibers that are woven into warp threads made of hemp, left exposed against the wooden frame to striking effect. And if you're looking at this reproduction, you don't really have a sense of the roughness or the rawness of it. But if you see it in the exhibition galleries upstairs, that is really clear. And the hemp is perhaps the most striking thing about it. Made in 1921, this chair is witness to the fact that even after the end of the war and the cessation of the blockade, the rampant inflation that lasted until the end of 1923 made it difficult for Germany to purchase import items on the international market. And the use of the thickly twined hemp as the background of the tapestry weaving allowed the artists to make use of homegrown materials while reducing the amount of expensive import fibers. The same is true of these carpets by the Bauhaus weavers Benita Kochotto and Alain Müller-Hellwig, the warp threads of which are made of jute into which wool and cotton are woven. Ultimately, though, it proved too difficult to collect native plants like hemp and jute in the wild and transport them to facilities that could process them in the quantities necessary to outfit a military and civilian population, and impractical to plant and grow them in more convenient locations. So, in a last-ditch effort to meet the country's textile needs during the war and inflationary era, Germany put all its efforts into perfecting another Ersatzfiber, Kunstseide, which literally translates as artificial or art silk, better known in English as rayon. Made out of chemically treated cellulose, the natural polymer that makes up the living cells of all vegetation, rayon was the first synthetic fiber, much touted in ads like this one, that conveys the sense of alchemical magic that was indeed involved in the process of transforming plants and trees into skeins of colorful artificial silk. Here, a bit of technical information is perhaps helpful. The idea to produce a fiber industrially had its origins in the process by which caterpillars known as silkworms transform the material of the mulberry leaf, their only sustenance, into cocoons, each of which consists of a single strand of silk that can be up to 1,500 meters in length. To harvest the silk, the cocoons are boiled, then laboriously unwound into single fibers that are twisted together into thread or yarn. Since the chief component of the mulberry leaf, like that of any leaf, is cellulose, it was theorized that fibers might be produced directly from cellulose without the intermediary work of the temperamental silkworm. In 1884, a method was discovered of dissolving nitrated cellulose in ether and alcohol. In its form as a viscous solution, cellulose is a thick liquid, as seen here. Rayon is made by forcing this liquid through tiny holes in spinnerets, from which it emerges in the form of fine filaments. Once extruded, the filaments are coagulated or solidified either by evaporation of the chemical solvent through exposure to air or by passing through a setting bath, after which they are washed, gathered onto skeins, put on bobbins, and finally sent to textile factories. Prior to World War I, rayon was used primarily in the notions industries because the methods used to produce the fiber were not yet terribly sophisticated, and rayon yarn could not compare to silk or fine cotton. And I think you can get a sense for that here. And this is a it's rayon embroidery around the edge of a cotton handkerchief, and you can feel sort of the roughness of it. It was World War I that provided the incentive to improve the quality of the rayon fibers, and it is notable that it was in Germany where this happened. Cut off from imports of cotton, wool, silk, and linen, German chemists perfected the fiber to the point where it could be woven into yard goods for clothing. Already by 1917, earlier than elsewhere, women's clothing in Germany was being made out of artificial silk. Both the dark skirt under the lace pinafore on the right and the striped skirt on the left were made out of so-called Atlas silk, which was a common brand name at the time for rayon. Now note, if you would, the high sheen of the rayon cloth in these images. This is an essential characteristic of rayon that results from the way in which the fiber is produced. Extruded rayon fibers are flat and smooth, unlike cotton, silk, or wool, which are either twisted, round, or scaly. They thus reflect more light. And though rayon producers ultimately learn to deluster the yarn when desired, rayon is by nature glossy. This made it particularly suited to serving as an effect fiber when used in combination with duller materials, as you can see here in this cotton cloth that's interwoven with rayon threads, or here, to get back to the Bauhaus, I am returning to the Bauhaus, in this bit of suiting fabric by the Bauhaus weaver Günter Stürzo, in which the white rayon fibers enliven the otherwise flat cotton and wool blend. And I think you can probably see that best here on the edge, where you can see the sheen of it. And in fact, the inherent sheen of artificial silk, rayon, and its ability to provide visual incident beyond color and pattern is strikingly evident in this pairing that you can see upstairs in the galleries. These are two wall hangings by Annie Albers, both of them made in 1925. And they are, in fact, installed one right next to the other. And what I'm about to say is much more evident when you're looking at the works themselves than in reproduction, where it hardly conveys at all, I'm sorry to say, but go look at them because it's really wonderful. The one on the right is made only of wool and silk, whereas the one on the left is made of silk, cotton, and what the wall label describes as acetate, which is a particular kind of rayon. Stunning in effect because of its flickering, shimmery surface, it doesn't, as I said, convey so well in reproduction. It's yet another testament to the innovations that emerged out of the material poverty of World War I and the inflationary era. As is this fabric, another piece that's in the Bauhaus exhibition by Annie Albers, used as a wall covering in an auditorium of a trade school. It's an innovative blend of chenille that absorbs sound and cellophane that reflects light. Like rayon, cellophane is also a cellulose derivative that the Bauhaus weavers made use of from the mid-1920s on. Because of their flatness and smoothness, rayon fibers also wet out very easily, and they thus take dyes better than most other fibers that need longer to get penetration. Performers like the flamboyant Anita Baba, here in Otto Dix's 1925 portrait of her and in a photo of one of her dances, liked the high-keyed color and the luster of pure artificial silk, in part because it served to accentuate their often eccentric personas offstage, as well as make more visible their movements on stage. Indeed, the sets of reviews and cabarets in which dancers and actors like the Tiller Girls and Anita Baba performed were themselves draped with yards and yards of rayon, which Berlin stage designers used extensively in the 1920s to create stunning visual effects that, as you know, we've talked about already, these black and white photographs can hardly convey, but were much discussed in the press at the time. Rayon was also used in shop window and exhibition displays because its high-keyed color and sheen was eye-catching and because it was much more inexpensive than silk, the effects of which it mimicked. The cheapest grades of rayon cost about 3/4 the price of real silk, while medium-grade yard goods cost about 1/2 the price, and the finest, most expensive grades cost about 1/4. There is little doubt, in fact, that much of the fabric in Mies van der Rohe's and Lilly Reich's, and this is my one connection to Lilly Reich today, sorry, famed velvet and silk cafe was not real silk, but in fact artificial silk or rayon. Both in terms of visual effect and of cost, the designers could, as it were, get more bang for their buck by using rayon. In fact, rayon's low cost is one of the most interesting things about it, especially as it relates to women's clothing of the interwar period. For the first time, women of modest means, who previously could only have worn wool, cotton, or linen because they could not afford the luxury of real silk, could purchase clothing that simulated silk in look and feel. Be it with stockings such as those advertised in these ads for Agfa, Kutna, and Bembeg rayon, and those of you who speak German might be a little confused by this because you'll know it says Agfa Seide, Agfa silk, or Bembeg Seide, Bemberg silk. It wasn't silk at all. They were common brand names for rayon that everybody knew what it was. So be it stockings, rayon stockings, lingerie made out of Glanzstoff, which was another brand name for rayon that played off on this inherent sheen of rayon that I've talked about, or outerwear made of Breda rayon, women could now outfit themselves in artificial silk for a fraction of the price of the real thing. This democratization of fashion was the subject of many articles in German women's and textile magazines of the interwar period. As one writer put it in 1928, it's now difficult for the well-off lady to call attention to her status through outward appearances. To be sure, the higher quality of her clothing might distinguish her, but such quality will be obvious only to the cultivated, trained eye. Superficially, the clothes are exactly the same. If the judge's wife wears a real fur with a pure silk lining, the unmarried factory worker will wear a fake fur with an artificial silk lining, and both will look equally elegant. If the wealthy cosmopolitan clads her legs in the finest silk stockings, the calves of her less financially fortunate sister will also shimmer, but in artificial silk, and no one will be able to tell the difference. That is to say, class boundaries, if not necessarily entirely permeable, were rendered considerably less visible with the development of rayon, a fact that may account in part for the many images produced in 1920s Germany of women's legs, a symbol not just of the emancipated new woman who now wore short skirts, but as well of freedom from class distinctions that previously had been immediately evident via bulky cotton or wool stockings. It goes without saying that this was liberating and heady for some, but nervous-making for others, especially men who could no longer size up women at a glance because their clothing did not immediately give their class away. I'd like to close with this photograph of the Bauhaus student Michiko Yamawaki at the loom. A shadowy yet composed presence behind the scrim of warp threads, Yamawaki sits weaving a tapestry or carpet. At her feet in the right foreground, a box or drawer with compartments, some of which are empty, some of which are filled with what would appear to be yarn, perhaps woven into samples, perhaps not. It's a small thing, barely visible, difficult to read, and at first glance incidental to the image of the focused student hard at work behind. Yet I would propose that we consider this container, half empty, half filled with bits and pieces of tangled, scruffy fibers, together with their transformation in the warp and weft of the weaving behind, as emblematic of how German artists and designers responded to the material poverty of World War I and the inflation. Developing new media like photomontage and assemblage, and new materials like rayon, they, in effect, made lemonade out of lemons, invigorating the visual and material culture of the era at the most unlikely of times. It was, indeed, no small feat. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, excuse me. Thank you all very much for your talks. I think because Maria Michaelis spoke last, I wanted to first begin by seeing if either of you wanted to talk a little bit about Lilly Reich and Quinsida and rayon, if you have thoughts about the sort of displays, Matilda, that you talked about, or the typewriter design for printed fabrics that you showed, because right. That was under Lilly Reich, and so maybe putting that together a little.
I mean, I don't know so much about the detail in terms of what kinds of fibers they used during that time, but I know that when she, or at least at the workshop, but I know that she did a lot of textile exhibitions using, I think she used artificial silk in several of them, but mainly they were, I think, the Wertheim department store, but also some of the companies that, well, certainly in sort of the larger exhibitions, the material show, that were companies sponsored these particular exhibits, and she would, you know, kind of use the material in that way, displayed mm-hmm. on textiles. So I know that she was, and she worked closely with industry, too, of course, during 32 and 33, and even before that. And I know that was, you know, one of the sort of the focus of the weaving workshop was to try to really implement many of these designs that they mm-hmm. came up with. Mm-hmm.
That typewriter fabric is upstairs in the galleries, and it is out of, it's either totally out of rayon or a rayon blend. I think it might be totally out of rayon.
I think it's
but
totally
it's installed
rayon.
Flat. But if you hang it up, you can really see the shimmer. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, just for those of you who go upstairs, but it doesn't really convey that shimmery surface that I think is so spectacular in some of these designs.
And I wonder if at the Bauhaus, would they have produced these fabrics, or were the rayon fabrics being produced outside and the designs are coming from the Bauhaus under Lilly Reich and being...
They would have probably, what they would have done is done some hand-woven samples and then gone to various sort of larger mills for production. But it's funny because when I think of Lilly Reich, I don't think of glossy, well, that's not true, of really, especially in fabrics, but of glossy surfaces. I think of sort of the sheen in terms of, you know, the glass and,
that's an interesting,
you know, the marble.
Connection.
But I don't, but in terms of clothing, it's harder to think of her using kind of a glimmery fabric.
Right. So. Well, the Günter Stutz, a little bit of fabric that I showed, it was very low-key, the suiting fabric, mm-hmm. right? It was just an effect fiber that kind of picked up the flatness of the...
But what does strike me, at least in the way that Lilly Reich herself dressed, is a sort of contrast in textures. And, you know, there would be fur with something very shiny and something very matte, mm-hmm. you know, that maybe... something shiny, you know, in moderation with something.
Right. It's
else.
Kind of an accent, yeah. which is what you had
right.
shown. Yeah.
Right. And then, Despina, you ended your talk with the idea of reinvention, and I thought that was a sort of something that maybe tied these talks together in terms of her having had a career in the imperial period, then the period of the war, and then after. She's almost a, you know, maybe to address what the war, this specific instance of you know, a fabric and the shift in fabrics that are available, but maybe in other ways to sort of think of what do you mean exactly by reinvention in her case and for architects and women architects in this period, because it does almost seem like two different lives.
There's a lot of reinvention going on, and it's not only for women. Part of what really interests me about the pre-war period is the ways in which architecture and design are shifting and the competition that emerges for these new markets. And so I think there is continuity in that respect, and it's both men and women who are male and female architects and designers who are trying to figure out what new markets they can explore and how they're going to reach new clients and clientele. But for women designers, given the fact that they were effectively excluded from so many parts of the of employment and of established markets, there was a need to invent new products, to invent a new clientele. And I think that kind of imaginative and inventiveness in terms of markets and products carries over into the Bauhaus era and is very much there, actually, in the textile workshop.
Mm-hmm. One, I mean, also speaking of reinvention, I mean, within, I'm not sure what happens in the Nazi period. She doesn't come to the United States when Mies comes? Is she...
Well, she did come. Mies came in 38, and she came to visit him in 39, thinking that I think she thought that she might stay, or that he wanted her to stay, and basically was, I think, rejected. And so she went back, and also there was... I mean, she still had an office during this whole time through her, you know, up until her death in 47, and she was handling... There was, I think, legal suits going on in terms of furniture, his furniture. She was still doing work for him in Germany. So I think she was, you know, she still had some loose ends to to tie up mm-hmm. back in Germany, so she did return. But I think it was always with the idea when she went over there that she would, if she went back to Germany, she would return to the United States, mm-hmm. but that never happened. Mm.
And I was also interested in your the point that her archive was destroyed in a bombing or her papers. And
from her, probably more from her earlier career, because when she, during the war, she did, with the help of Ernst Ludwig, she did have Mises drawings as well as hers that were part of that. They went to a farmhouse, and that's where they were kept safe. Mm-hmm. But there was still, I'm certain, you know, a number of projects, drawings for projects that were in her studio that were destroyed.
Because mm-hmm. I was thinking about the kind of question of collaboration and the need to sort of bring Lily Reich back into the picture, partly because she worked with such a illustrious figure as Mies, and there's always that sort of, you know, who gets credit. But then also wondering if the fact that her entire oeuvre is not known is also a factor in what made her a little...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting when one thinks about what Mies accomplished while he was collaborating with her. I mean, that's the time... I mean, after their collaboration ended, or when he came to the United States, he didn't do any other furniture anymore. I mean, he did the furniture only with Lily Reich, and so I think their collaboration was fairly intense, and I think that there was probably a submissiveness on her part too in letting him be the sort of the primary architect. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, she certainly, through kind of publications and what is published of her work, she certainly, from her early career, she was one of, I can think, one of the pioneering women.
Mm. And I mean, how technically were you able to sort of discern what was...
Well, it was easy when her stamp was on the drawing, and it said Atelier L. Reich. But sometimes it was clearer than others, and there was, you know, a couple of us working on it. Pierre Adler, who was working in the Mies archive at the time. I was in the Mies archive, and then there was, you know, several other people that were closely, that knew Mies's work pretty intensely. So I think it was... kind of discussions that we had that we were able to make some, you know, many determinations, but I think there's still some that are unclear. Mm-hmm. But I think that in some ways it's interesting with drawings. Drawings lead to, and in the case of Mies and Lily Reich, most of the drawings led to a finished product, or a lot of the drawings led to a finished product. And I think that was always... Lily Reich's intent. And so does it really matter who did the drawing? Mm-hmm. It's really sort of the design of it that I think is the most important, the concept. Mm-hmm. And that comes through, I think, discussion and collaboration that can't always be captured right. in an architecture mm-hmm. office. And so we immediately think that whoever drew it is the author, like in mm-hmm. a book. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's not the case.
Can I just add that yes. part of the issue here, too, is the way that we write design history or architectural history, and that the necessity to kind of pull these collaborations apart mm-hmm. is intrinsically problematic, inherently problematic, in that it wants to undo the whole point of the collaboration in the first place. But the problem is that we don't have a way to write about it. Mm-hmm. And so we are, you know, mm-hmm. then forced to do mm-hmm. this kind of dissection that undermines the intentions of the artist in the first place.
Right. But in some cases, one wants to do that in order to give credit.
Yes, especially for women working in partnerships, this is an enormous problem, because given that it's difficult to write about and recognize partnerships as being something else, but equally valid to the sort of the model of the individual artist, it means that usually the collaborating partner, if it's a woman, just simply gets written out of the picture entirely. So, you know,
you're back to the monograph method. Right.
So at this point, I'd like to open the discussion to the floor. I think you need to, if you have a question, you need to speak into a mic. So if you, yes, please.
I was going to ask, and it's a question for all three of you, in a way of trying to tie some of these ideas together. Despina, at one point in your talk, you mentioned how in the imperial period, women who are interested in architecture are often kind of given the opportunity of being depicted as sort of hermaphroditic or as housewives' helpers, in the sense that they're catering to a sort of domestic aesthetic. But at the end of your paper, it in a sense comes back to consumption and women as consumers, which is something that's highlighted in the other two talks as well. If we think about the textiles and women's fashions or even the apartment and sort of living spaces. And given the emphasis in the Bauhaus on sort of the marriage of form and function and the emphasis on living, I'm wondering to what extent is that a transition that we see within the understanding of the purpose of art that's sort of common to all Bauhaus artists? Is Lily Reich and other women of the Bauhaus, are they different in terms of how they approach the woman as a consumer and as a consuming agent? I'm not sure if that question's clear or not, but how that role as the woman as consumer actually fits into some of these things that are that you're talking about.
Well, in the pre-war period, I think that women artists, women designers, but also, as I mentioned, you know, like the Wertheim department store and other sort of firms like that, recognize that there's a tie between women producers and consumers and go out and sort of really try to develop that and highlight women artists to bring in female consumers. And I don't know what happens in the Bauhaus period, if that sort of connection is seen as being equally something attractive or not. That's a great question. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about sort of the other women. I mean, I think the weaving workshop out of all of the workshop was the most successful in terms of really putting out work for, you know, industrial production that was made available to the public. Most of the other was kind of, I mean, there was sort of more handmade. I mean, it was really kind of handcrafted. So, I mean, in that way, I don't know if it was just the medium of textiles that made it too kind of easier to do that, and that there were certainly textile mills nearby that made it kind of a natural sort of medium to work with and to market.
I don't know either.
I mean, part of the reason I think we don't know is that we have, in some ways, not really put these two things together in the way that we clearly need to. You know, you either think about the artist as a producer or you think about department stores and consumption, and we kind of, Wertheim, for example, would be a great case study to look at sort of how are they putting this together.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, so a lot of the products designed, especially at the early Bauhaus, they were one-off things, you know, wall hangings.
Right.
And it's in the later Bauhaus, in the late 20s, when, you know, in the weaving workshop,
right,
they begin to design textiles for industrial production, but not necessarily just for women, you know, like the little bit of suiting fabric that I showed, I don't even know if that was for a woman or a man. Probably a woman, I would imagine. But
when did Lily die, and what did she do after the war?
She died in 1947, and not a lot is known. I think she was actually quite destitute. She had a few small jobs, but I think she was really quite poor during the war. And then she became quite ill think with I think she had some kind of cancer, and then died in 47. So she didn't have a lot of work during the war. But I think her main motivation during that, between 33 when the Werkbund basically closed, and then sort of right after the war, was to try to revive that. And I think there was only a couple of years. But it was very difficult because they weren't, you know, they didn't want to have organized groups in Germany. So it was very difficult to try to organize or reorganize the Werkbund.
I have a little anecdote that doesn't really have anything to do with Lilly Reich, but has to do with the war and the aftermath, which was that in the Nazi era, rayon becomes a kind of national fabric or fiber, autarkic, because it could be produced within the boundaries of Germany. And so it was very much celebrated and used, encouraged, and subsidized. And
Should I?
I was
just going to.
Another question.
I have not really a question, but sort of a coda to this, which for Maria, which I don't know, maybe a lot of you know, but in post-war America, the silk stocking story or the nylon story, I think it's in Michael's wonderful book on plastics, that they, again, it has to do with the question on consumers and women, but they ratcheted up the demand that American women felt for nylon stockings so that they then held off on putting them in the department stores. And when they finally did, there were practically a massacre. But it really had to do with, you know, turning that whole story of rayon and silk stockings, nylons, into definitely a consuming tool for women in post-war America.
I was just curious if you knew how the rayon from the 1920s has held up in comparison to kind of the cottons and the wools. Does it age faster? Does it kind of fall apart faster or that kind of thing compared to
I'm
the natural?
I'm sorry, products? I don't know that. Maybe there's maybe a textile.
Conservator.
Valerie, back for window.
I actually just did an Annie Albers piece for the Guggenheim in Berlin, put it on exhibition, I did fiber ID, and it had rayon on it, used as an effect, like you had mentioned, and it's great. No real condition problems at this point that we've been able to ascertain.
I mean, in the end, rayon, it's treated chemically, but it's a natural, it's like cotton. I mean, some rayon is produced from cotton. In Germany during the war, it was not from cotton because they couldn't get the cotton. It was produced from spruce trees, actually. But,
I was just curious about how women fared in innovation after the Bauhaus closed and things kind of, and the war progressed. Were they able to then resurface and do more great things?
The highest enrollment in architecture departments in Germany occurs during the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And so, yet again, in terms of reinvention, women recognized that architecture was highly, was clearly the art that was the most respected and praised under Adolf Hitler, and they go and they enroll in architecture departments. So it's not what we expect, actually, and I think a lot more work needs to be done on that period because the assumption has been that women designers couldn't find work or didn't work in that period, and many, of course, did. Many had to emigrate or, you know, met with worse ends than that. But disturbingly, perhaps the Third Reich period ends up being a fairly productive period for some women artists.
I don't know again. I'm sorry.
I don't know absolutely for sure, but I would imagine that in textiles, I think it probably, it was always, you know, fairly full of women. But also, there were certainly a few men in the Bauhaus weaving workshop. I think you saw a couple of, in the images that I showed, two images that I showed, there was a couple of men. So,
I guess
guess I was more interested in not so much that they were doing it, but were they doing it innovatively and different? Mm.
I don't know. We got another I don't know. More research.
Well, I'm one of the women who trained in architecture, and again, I'm going here from, I'm referring to architecture because that's what I know, but one of the women who trained in architecture at the Bauhaus, one of the few women to train in that field, Vera Meyer Waldeck, in the Third Reich period, worked on the Autobahns. Mm-hmm. So there's some really interesting stories in terms of continuities there, surprising continuities in innovation.
So I think we can probably take maybe one more question, and then we'll need to wrap it up. Any other?
Was there any more communication between Mies and Lily after she left America at all, or just that was it?
There is some documentation. I think the papers are split between the Library of Congress and MoMA, and I think we have the papers that deal mainly with professional work, and I think there was correspondence that was basically just dealt with professional projects, the things that were still hanging in Germany that she was wrapping up. But in terms of anything in the Library of Congress that was of a more personal nature, I don't think so.
She wasn't able to come here. I mean, you said she tried, but there wasn't any place for her, like at Harvard or in the universities or anything like that.
She wasn't invited, unlike, you know, the Albers who were invited to, you know, Black Mountain College and Mies. So it was, and I think a lot of it probably was that Mies didn't really want her. He was beginning a new life here in the United States, and I think he was ultimately decided that was, he wanted to break his life into two parts, and the first part was over, the German part.
Are there any memoirs in English that talk, or biographies or anything that talk more about her, or is everything German?
Well, Sonja Günther, but that's in German. But really, there's nothing more except we did a small publication for the Lily Reich Show in 1996, which I think is out of print. But I'm sure you can find them on Amazon.com.
And in MoMA's library, of course.
And if you want to, I talk about her contribution to that show, Die Frauenhaus in Beruf, in my book, and I look more closely at sort of the responses to her designs, but there isn't very much in any language, unfortunately.
Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thanks.